But the first thing to say about this little system with all these rules in it is that these things are really powerful. These are not minor kind of things. These are things that sort of grab hold of us, and we feel stuck with this. Often we'll look at other roles and see, I'd rather be the hero. I remember as a lost child, my lost child years, thinking all those other roles look better to me. I just got sick and tired of being the lost child. And if there had been a vacancy in one of those roles, I would have snapped at it. The really important thing to recognize is that changing roles in an addicted family system doesn't get you out of the system. There are no good choices here. There are no life-giving choices. There are no roles that sort of fit who you are well. They're all roles that sap the life juices out of you. But the desire to switch roles is also very common. It's not really that we choose to switch roles, it's that we can be reassigned to a different role. It's not that I woke up one morning and said, I'd like to be the hero in the family because I'm tired of being a lost child, but a vacancy emerged. My brother, the oldest child, was the hero in our family for many years, and then he did a series of very, very non-heroic things. He got sick and tired of being the hero, and basically, I don't want to go into all that story, but there, a vacancy emerged in the hero role. I'm suffering as a lost child. Like, awesome! I'll be the hero for a while. That looks good to me. He doesn't seem like he's getting hurt as much as I'm getting hurt. Okay, and so that transition happened quickly. It was very easy to do. It didn't require any work because it's another role where there's a vacancy, and that happens all the time. People switch sometimes for long periods of time, sometimes for short periods of time. You can so these roles all have a sense of instability to them. You can be the hero for 20 years, but now for whatever reason, we need someone in the scapegoat role, and you're going to be the scapegoat. This can happen very, very quickly. This is a dynamic that happens often to caregivers, particularly pastors, I think, who try to work with a system like this. Pastors are used to being invited into families, right, to be part of the family, be with us on important family occasions, births and deaths. So you're inside the family, and if you're invited into an addictive family system, you might at first feel honored that people would trust you to invite you into the family system, and you might not notice that on the way in you've been assigned a role. Which of the roles are most likely to be assigned to pastors? They're going to be the hero, right? We have a vacancy in the hero role, and you're this perfect person. You have special access to God, you know? What a great hero to have in our family system. And you might even say, this feels really good. I'm getting all kinds of respect that I don't get normally from my congregation. These people seem to give me lots of positive attention. So this feels good. And then you wake up some morning and you're not the hero anymore, you are the scapegoat. And you can't figure out what you did. It's not like you did something to be reassigned. It's the system needed somebody more in the scapegoat role than in the hero role. You were available for reassignment, and boom, all of a sudden you're the bad guy. You're the problem. Okay? And there's no appeal board. There's no, it's you. You have been reassigned. So if you don't kind of notice going in that you've been that you're entering an addictive family system, you can get really blindsided by those kind of dynamics. But it's very, very common for people to be reassigned to different roles or have to occupy two roles because there's not another people. But that goes to, the, I think, what's the next point? This is the point I'm making. Caregivers will be invited to participate in the system, almost always as the hero. The system exists to sustain itself. That's the point. This is a very resilient system. If someone serving a role disappears, they die, they go to jail for the rest of their lives, they're gone, there's a vacancy, the system will fill that vacancy. It's a very resilient system. It can go on for multiple generations, and it won't seem like there's a, people may not have any conscious awareness that there's this system that dominates their lives, or they may look in a mirror and then walk away and forget what they looked like, that sort of dynamic. So you get some sense that this, something's wrong here, but can't stay with it. That's also very common. So the roles are powerful. It's easy to switch roles, both at different stages of life. I was a lost child. I was a hero. Then the scapegoat role became open again, and I became the scapegoat in my family. Sustained that for actually quite a while. And eventually, thank God, I realized that there were no roles here that I wanted to play. I didn't know how to get out of this, but there just weren't any roles here I was willing to play anymore. I'm just sick and tired of the whole thing. I'm not going to get my hopes up about being reassigned to the mascot role because I hadn't tried that yet. There's no good roles here. So people don't get better by getting reassigned. But getting reassigned is the first, is kind of the only option that people think of. This is the known universe for people in this system. That there's different ways of being in the world is just not accessible to people in an addicted family system. This goes out to the horizon. This is all there is. There are no other way of being. Typically, this is the lecture that when I give it, people feel like deer in the headlights. Yeah, this is like, have you been watching my life kind of thing? Because these sort of dynamics are really common, not just in addicted family systems, but any kind of dysfunctional family system. I think they're particularly common in sort of stressed family system. If you have a family member who has a significant physical or mental disability, that can affect a family in the same way. They're sort of in the role of the dependent person. They're dependent on other people for care. There's a codependent who does nothing but take care of this person. There's the lost child who knows they can't compete for attention with the special needs kid. There's the hero who wants to make up for the problem so that the family will be happy again about how good their kids are. Same sort of dynamics happen. So even if you have no addiction in your family system, this is one of the ways family systems go bad. And I can't protect you from that. the main advice at this point, I'm going to say a lot about this after the break of how to get out of here. Most important thing to observe is that switching roles, being reassigned to a different role, doesn't take you out. That's not a pathway out, even though that may be the only thing that occurs to you. There has to be something outside this system that you are carried to, that you are rescued by. All right? And this is why, again, going back to the pastoral roles or therapeutic roles for that matter, the goal is not to get inside the system and be in there. You have to be outside this system and call people out. You have to be close enough to observe these dynamics, but not so close that you're just in it. That's a lot of the art of ministry, the art of therapeutic interventions is, you know, being close enough to be able to identify and be empathic, and at the same time being far enough outside that you can help people get out. And what that looks like. Well, we've been through what that looks like for the addicted person, right? Recommended 12 steps as the pathway to get out of the family system for that person. But what does an addicted person who starts to get help for himself experience? They go to treatment. Maybe they have a bajillion dollars. They go to a 6-month treatment program. They get 6 months of sobriety. They come back home, and where are they? There they are, embedded in the same system they left 6 months ago. And everything about that is sort of dragging them back into the system. And they're trying to say, I'm not part of this anymore. I'm out here. But if nobody else has gotten help, right, this sort of pull back into the system is pretty strong dynamic. They're going back, living on the same turf, you know, and that's pretty tough.
So would you say getting help and really just owning who you are as a person and not letting all of these negative emotions continue this function? Is that like how you would think of a solution?
Yeah, we've talked a lot more, and we have, it's sort of classic, we have talked much more about this class of how the addicted person gets out, right? You have to find a new way of life. You know, a daily retrieve based on the maintenance of your spiritual condition. Some sort of dynamic like that is necessary for everybody else in the system. It is just not true that the person who's the identified addict in an addicted family system is the person with the biggest problem. It's not true. I think my son, who's the identified addict, alcoholic in our family system, even when he was actively using, I think was a little healthier than I was at the time. Because I was deeply embedded in stuff. I need help just as much as he needed help. And I think that's generically true of addicted family systems, that no one here is leading a life that, when you see it, you would choose. Right. So they need some sort of pathway out. What that looks like, for the enabler, I think 12-step programs is also a really good idea. There's lots of stuff out there: Families Anonymous, CODA groups, Al-Anon groups. Working the steps is also a pathway out for them. For children of addicts and alcoholics, there are some really good programs. Confident Kids is the one I mentioned because I played a role in helping it get started. But there's also Alateen, Alatot, that can be pathways out. And also, I think it depends on the age that people are when they first identify, I'm living an unsustainable life. I'm living this role that I didn't choose, that doesn't fit me. Sometimes therapy can be profoundly helpful. That was really my pathway. Therapy at least helped me see that what was my known universe wasn't the whole universe. It was just this little, small, constricted, you know, the bandwidth was very low. And opening up other possibilities, and just by sometimes it was simple stuff, just saying, you know, there's other ways of doing this. And to me, it was like a light bulb going off. It's like, I never would have thought of that. I just so outside of my experience. So there's lots of ways out. People are not stuck for life in these roles. All of us are in process. If we got some of this stuff going on in our lives, it's not this hopeless, gloomy thing. There are pathways out. Right? It doesn't have to be like this. And we'll find ourselves in other family systems. And find ourselves sort of aware. Well, I'm thinking about marriage now. That's the honest truth. I got married. Both of us. Both my wife and I threw all our worldly goods in the back of a Volkswagen Bug in 1971 and left town, and we thought, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we're free at last. We're not carrying all that crap with us. We're free now to be who we are, you know? And it turned out we were carrying with us in the Volkswagen a lot more stuff than we had any awareness of. We both had just staggering amounts of baggage that we were carrying with us. And as we tried to form a relationship, of course, in some ways our baggage matched, so that we were just recreating the kind of this kind of pathology in our relationship. Fortunately, there was enough difference that it created conflict, and we had to work on some stuff. But we, you know, all this stuff that this system represents is stuff we gave to our kids before we knew we had stuff. We gave all our stuff to our kids before we knew we had stuff, which is how this stuff gets transmitted from generation to generation. And thankfully, I credit my son's chaos and insanity a lot for sort of shaking the family system. It was like, this doesn't work anymore. And that sort of forced us all to get more help than we'd ever gotten before, to take a real... And then it's about breaking the cycle. How do you stop this in a family system? You don't stop it by just saying, okay, I'm not going to do that anymore. It's dependent on the daily maintenance of your spiritual condition. So it's a long process. Sometimes getting rid of this stuff is, again, I will talk after the break about why it's so hard to get rid of this stuff. Because it's not just the psychological dynamics that are at work here. This is what the class is really about, is there's also some spiritual dynamics that this family system uses to keep itself together. That's what we'll talk about after the break.
The thing I want to talk about is the kind of spiritual attachments that people in addictive systems make. Because in an addictive family system, you not just have people in these really restrictive roles. These people make attachments to different deities. Okay? They have, sometimes I use the language, they have distorted images of God. I use that language less and less. There was a time when I first realized that I had a really distorted image of God. But that metaphor assumes I was looking at the living and true God, but there's just kind of a filter that made it hard to distorted things. I think it's closer to the truth to say that I was not looking at the living and true God at all. I was looking over here at an idol that I had constructed for myself out of my experiences with mortal men, just as Paul suggests. This is the small piece of Dale Ryan that's very Calvinist. I believe in total depravity. I think Calvin was right when he said, from our mother's womb, we are makers of idols. We create gods for ourselves out of our experiences with mortal men. And people in addictive family systems do that as well. What sort of spiritual connections would you expect people in these different roles to make? What sort of gods would they gravitate to? Towards. And my instincts is that people gravitate towards gods that match their role in the family system. So, for example, the addicted person is going to gravitate towards gods that are pretty narcissistic, selfish, gods that are kind of irrelevant, you know. If I'm addicted, I may know all the theology about God, but it's kind of irrelevant really to my life. And that's going to be the kind of God that I feel in relationship to. Someone that matches my own narcissism, my own selfishness, and that matches my sense that nothing really matters. If I'm in the enabler role, I think I'm going to be attaching myself to gods that are absent. God's not here. Or inadequate gods. Gods that are absent or inadequate. I've got all this work I'm doing, you know.
But it's, I know it's stuff that God should be doing, but you know, God's not doing it, so I guess I'm the one who has to do this stuff. You know, I'm kind of resentful towards God's inability to rescue my husband from self-destruction. But I don't know where God is, why God isn't doing this, but I guess I'm called to do what God's not willing or able to do. And you can hear the martyrdom of that. I'm going to suffer. I know I'm suffering. I'm resentful about my suffering, but I'm attached to a God who requires that of me. He requires my martyrdom to get things done. Even though I think God really ought to be doing this stuff. A hero, we've actually talked about the kind of gods to which heroes gravitate, the God of impossible expectations, really demanding God. It's not just that the family system requires me to keep getting it right, to keep being good, to keep being successful. It's that God, you know, the gods that I find myself in relationship to also require that of me. So I'm not just, if I fail, I'm not just letting down my family, I'm letting down the God of my family. You know, the God that I've attached myself to, that I learned about in my family. A God that's pretty demanding. The God, I think I mentioned earlier, this notion that I'm climbing, I want to be a good Christian, I'm climbing up this ladder towards God, and God reaches down and puts more rungs on the ladder. That sort of God is the God to which people in the hero role frequently attach themselves. A lost child is going to, again, match his own experience. God's absent. God's unavailable. There's nothing really I can do except hide. This is Adam in the garden. Adam and Eve in the garden. What are they doing? They're hiding. And intellectually, doesn't make much sense. How do you hide in God's garden? It's not going to work. But that's the instinct of the lost child, that God really is unavailable, just like my parents were unavailable. Just like, you know, there's nobody there, really, for a lost child. So it's just impossible for a lost child. Imagine a God who shows up. A, you don't want anybody to show up because you're happy being by yourself. Happy is the wrong word. And you don't realize how much pain you're in, but it feels a little bit better when you're by yourself. So you don't really want God to show up and spoil the plan you have for your life, which is to hide out. Scapegoats tend to gravitate towards gods that are pretty punitive and unfair, you know. God is just like the life I experience, is you get blamed for stuff that you didn't do. You get, you sort of carry the shame of the family in a visible way by being bad, and God's just as unfair as my parents have been. They're constantly talking about my problems and never fessing up to their own. You know, that's pretty unfair. And what I do is I get, what can I expect from God? It's the same thing I expect from everybody in my life. I expect to get punished. I'm bad, I get punished. That's the life of the scapegoat, and it's that instinct, that whatever that is, that tends to dominate the spiritual relationships of someone in the scapegoat role. And then finally, the mascot, often find themselves in a, you know, related to gods who need to be appeased. They're angry, or gods that need to be distracted. Right? I need to do something so that God doesn't notice. Just the way I act in any other relationship. I do something. Can I do something to make God happy? That's really a deeply mascot-oriented thing. And it is You know, if you think of a mascot when they're fairly young, 10, 11, they may be encouraged to think, if you do these things, God's happy, and if you do these things, God's sad. This was part of my world when I was 11. I was in charge of God's mood. If I did this stuff, God's happy. If I do this stuff, God's sad. I think that's a pretty emotionally fragile God that can, where 10-year-old Dale Ryan can jerk his chain, you know, and he's sort of flipping back between happy or sad, depending on what little Dale Ryan does. I think the God of the Bible is a little bit more robust than that, can handle a wide range of emotional experiences. Now, these gods, small g gods, fit neatly into the addicted family system. They reinforce the structure of the family system. So it's not just kind of the psychological dynamics that are at work here. It's also psychological dynamics reinforced by people's attachment to gods who are not God. And so to change anything requires not just getting out of the family system psychologically, but it requires a fine breaking, letting go of spiritual attachments, idolatrous attachments. So it's, getting out feels not only like you're abandoning the family, it feels like you're leaving the only gods you've ever known. And that's not easy, right? Because it's hard enough to leave your family, but this may very well be the only kind of God you've ever been attached to. And with that comes a lot of fear. Is there really another way to be? You know, is there something outside of this system, that is worth all the struggle and pain to get there from here? All those are part of any sort of healing process for people trying to get out of an addicted family system. All right, let's talk about what you can do about this.
Yeah.
Okay. So, what are the spiritual resources that would be helpful to these different people? How would you preach to someone who's in the addict role, who's sort of God is narcissistically involved, and either that or you're irrelevant? I think there's something to be made of a God who's intolerant of images, the God who's a jealous God, is not willing to, is not happy when we make up our own images, and also the God who seeks the lost. Okay, here's kind of a lost person. And I think there's a lot of ways you could talk about God seeking the lost. God who chooses to spend his time with someone as marginalized as an addict. God can show up in a drunk tank because that's his people. Right? We think God shows up in nice places, sanitized places. God shows up, read the book. God shows up for people who are in trouble, who are struggling, just like this guy. What are the biblical resources for someone in the enabler role who feels like God never shows up? I've got to do all this hard work because God's not available. Well, there's the whole notion of God, the creator of the universe. Like God's the creator and sustainer of the universe. Every beat of our heart, every breath we take, is God creating life in us and sustaining us. That's not a God at a distance. We have no entitlement to the next beat of our hearts, the next breath we take. It's the Creator that's doing that. And there's the God of the resurrection, pretty powerful. When you look around, it's just a mess. You're just working as hard as you can to clean up the mess, but it just feels like death
everywhere. This is territory where the God of the Bible feels comfortable. God's willing to go there. I ranted about the first two verses of Genesis 1, did it? Where is God and what is God doing? He's hovering over the unmanageability of things, the messiness of things, waiting for just the right time. That's what God is. It's a good summary for the whole text. Where is Jesus when things go so wrong? He's descending into hell. So that's the kind of place God shows up. Full of mystery, but it preaches. God's the Lord of the universe. God's the suffering servant. That role has been filled. You don't have to be like Jesus. Preach that sometime. You don't have to be like Jesus. It'd be better if you stopped trying to be like Jesus. I think that speaks quite directly to the kind of idolatrous attachments that enabler and codependence makes. How about the person in the hero role? This is about the God who loves people, even evil people, even people who are losers. I preach the love of God. Talk about the mistake of adding the word enough to the end of things. People in the hero role need to hear about the God of grace, and they need to know that rest was God's idea, right? That it's okay to stop. It's okay to stop doing the hero stuff. Indeed, it is a simple matter of obedience to a divine command to stop. So if you're expending your life in obedience to God, getting tired, the result is getting tired, God's call is to stop. Do Sabbath, do Jubilee if you have to, but stop. I think that speaks both tenderly and prophetically to someone in a hero role. At least you could start with texts like that and both be gentle and confrontive of people inside the system. How about the lost child? Lost childs have a hard time with the lost children have a hard time with the incarnation, with God with us. Not sure I want that. That feels scary. The God who pursues us, even scarier. A God who is present even if we make our bed in hell. Not a bad metaphor for what it feels like to be an addictive family system. It feels like trying to rest in a spiritually desolate place. God, those are the kind of places God shows up. The God who listens, who hears, are indeed, God doesn't just listen. Sometimes when we have no words, it is the Spirit that groans for us. God puts words to our suffering that we can't do ourselves. To a lost child, I think that could resonate quite deeply. For someone in the scapegoat role, there's just a long list of stuff. The God who is slow to anger and quick to forgive. Scapegoats have very little experience of that from people, and they're just immediately to blame for stuff. That's kind of the knee-jerk response of the universe to a scapegoat is it's your fault. And to think that God might hold back on such judgments is gospel. The God who's long-suffering, not willing that any should perish, that's gospel. God's patient. He's not, God's not about you need to get your act together right now. Right? God's a pretty patient God. Also, the notion that God is about justice, I think, is really important for scapegoats, because they've experienced a lot of injustice. They've experienced sort of being scapegoated as a way to avoid dealing with what really needs to be dealt with. And that's not fair. That's part of their instinct. It's not fair. And the notion that God has a sensibility about fair is pretty important. Also have here one that takes a long time to explain, but the notion that God is the one who brings scapegoating to an end. If you've, how many of you have heard the name René Girard? Anybody? René Girard was an anthropologist, floated a unique way of understanding the doctrine of atonement. And at heart, he noticed that in cultures of many kinds, scapegoating played a really important role in diffusing hostility in a culture. So cultures, when things get tense, will find someone to blame, and in scapegoating that person, the whole culture experiences relief. It doesn't have to make any sense who you choose to scapegoat, just as an addictive family system. It doesn't have to make any sense, but you find somebody and everybody conspires together to agree that if we do something to the scapegoat, things are going to be better. And the truth is, they do get better when people do. It's temporary. You need another scapegoat a little later. But Girard's understanding of atonement is that what God did in Jesus was to bring that dynamic to an end. Because any time you see someone and you want to scapegoat that person, we are now to see the face of Jesus and say, no, Jesus brought all scapegoating to an end. You remember the drama was Barabbas or Jesus? The authorities didn't care who you chose. Just find somebody to scapegoat. What we see God doing in the birth, life, death, and resurrection of Jesus is saying, game change here. We're just not going to do this anymore. Anything that needed to be done was done in Jesus. So we don't have to scapegoat anybody anymore. Whatever dynamic scapegoating was fulfilling was completely fulfilled in the death and resurrection of Jesus. I think that's a helpful way of thinking about the doctrine of atonement. It's got its limitations, like all the other theories about atonement. But I think that for someone who's been scapegoating to notice that Jesus was scapegoating, and to learn that we don't do that anymore. We just don't do it. Because someone suggests someone to scapegoat, and we say, you know, those are people Jesus loves. We're not going to scapegoat that person. Jesus was a game changer for that whole dynamic. Even if you're afraid, people also often feel a lot of fear about scapegoats. Right? So we're terrified of Syrian refugees. Christian sensibility is see the face of Jesus in each of them. These are people that God loves and cares about. It's okay to be afraid. All of us get afraid sometimes. But don't let it lead to scapegoating somebody. Because any scapegoating that ever needed to be done was done completely and fulfilled in Jesus. That was a very, very brief introduction to Girard. All right. How about the mascot? Something about the mascot dynamic that is I think it's something people do when they've given up on nurture. Remember watching a video of an orphanage in Bosnia during the Bosnian War. It was this room of infants wrapped the way you do in Eastern Europe, you know, kind of tightly wrapped, sitting in these cribs. Must have been 30 or 40, probably orphans, orphaned infants in this room, and it was absolutely silent. And my first thought was, isn't it amazing how you could have a room full of content infants in a room during wartime when probably weren't much resources or anything. They're all quiet. It only gradually occurred to me that these were infants who had given up on crime. They were no longer able to ask for nurture. They'd learned that there was no nurture to come. I think mascot stuff is like that. There's no possible way that there's enough resources available for me so that I can deal with this. So I have to distract. And so if you talk about a God who nurtures his people, God who's eager to feed his people, think manna in the wilderness, think the Eucharist. God has fed us with spiritual food. Think of all Jesus' stories that end with a feast. Right? God's all about nurturing his people. That's gospel to mascots. It's like almost unimaginable. If you don't have much life experience to hang that on. But it just needs to be preached over and over again. God loves to feed his people. And he does not need to be appeased. He does not need to be distracted. God's not, as you know, there's nothing you can, if God were angry, there's nothing you can do to distract him about it. Now, I think we make entirely too much of God's anger. I think we should have a place commensurate with the place it plays in the text. There's plenty of text about God's anger. But the notion that God's anger means he's not available to nurture us is what's really profoundly wrong. God doesn't get angry the way we get angry, I don't think. We get angry and we're just so angry about being angry. Right? I don't think God gets angry about being angry. That's the kind of stuff we do. And so we don't deal with it very well. We deflect it. We don't own it. You made me angry. That's how we experience it first. God doesn't do that either. He doesn't say, you made me angry. God gets angry sometimes. But he's still available to nurture us, to care for us. And, you know, the good news is all this stuff on the outside of this certain circle, it's all just really rich resources. This is just a hint at the depth of the biblical material that is available for people struggling with this stuff. It's not like we've got nothing to say here. This is all stuff that it may be hard for people to hear. But that's why, you know, when you preach, you figure you might be preaching into this family for more than one generation. Right? As the first time you preach that God's slow to anger and eager to forgive, it may not register very well. So you have to say it 10 different ways in 10 different sermons. Now, practical piece, if I were preaching on a regular basis, I would, every 6 months when I did a review of what I preached about, I would ask, well, when's the last time I optimized a sermon for a lost child? When's the last time I optimized a sermon for the needs of someone who's a mascot? And you use that as a way to make sure I'm reaching all the elements of the audience, right? Because you're going to have, there's going to be, these people are going to be there in the congregation.
And you want to make sure somehow that you're unpacking the text in a way that is accessible to people struggling with each of these different problems. That doesn't mean you have to, you know, show this graph or talk about addictions even. It's just you, you know, for the hero, you talk about God not needing the stuff that other people have communicated they need from you, and how it's okay. God is not traumatized when we get things wrong. Just, I mean, in this respect, it is, I just am myself quite moved by Jesus' teaching about, you know, if you being broken, damaged, hurting, struggling, missing the mark people can be good parents and give your kids good things, how much more is God going to be a better parent than that? Because sometimes we mess up our kids. We do things that are hurtful, and they wind up being part of systems like this. But God's not like that. I mean, this connects with the notion that we have been adopted into a different family and learning that there's different rules in God's family. There's a level of flexibility that the addictive family system does not offer us. You become a part of God's family, you're not assigned a role, right? You get to be who you are and sort of experience the wonder of who you are kind of growing in a safe space where you're loved, nurtured, where there's enough. That's kind of a fun thing to experience or to watch.